Over the next 4 years, McCluskey and the attorney he hired, Cheryl Whatley, unearthed a narrative entirely different from the one Spencer's jury had heard. They discovered that the police had botched the crime scene. They learned that investigators never found a single thing to connect Spencer to the assault. Not a murder weapon, not stolen property, not fingerprints. Reading the police investigative notes, they saw that the detectives had ignored every witness who didn't fit their story. A teenager who claimed she saw the perpetrator close up and swore it was not Spencer, and two men who implicated a different, viable suspect. Why? Detective Briseno believed he had found the men responsible for the crime, but McCluskey speculates that the detective already had what he needed to convince a jury, three eyewitnesses to identify Spencer, and a jailhouse informant to connect him to the assault, and after that, he stopped short of seeking the truth.
No other reason to make any kind of investigation. Once all that was developed within a week of the murder, the case was cleared, and he was the hero.
Over the summer of 2017, I attempted to reinvestigate the case. I largely retraced the steps that McCluskey and Whatley had trod 15 years ago. I start with the most pivotal question, the one they pondered. What could the eyewitnesses actually see on the night of March 22, 1987? Just past 10 p.m. on a sweltering June night, Cheryl Whatley and I have positioned ourselves in Gladys Oliver's yard. You'll remember she was the government's star witness. We're peering at the alley where the BMW had been parked. It's a moonless night, the alley lit by the same streetlight and porch light as 30 years ago.
So you can see the little side window there?
Right.
That's what Gladys had looking out from this side towards the alley.
It looks pretty dark back there.
Yeah.
I mean, was it that dark before?
Yeah.
I can't see anything back there.
Okay. So, by the way, Daryl, do me a favor. Go stand under that streetlight.
Daryl Parker, a private investigator who's helping with the case, strides toward the light. We know from police sketches that Oliver's bedroom window was 123 feet away from the BMW in the alley. Parker reaches the streetlight and turns around.
Who is it?
You can't see anything. You can see no facial
expression. You can see a silhouette of a man.
Right.
Parker surveys the crime scene. He's 5'8" tall, blonde and athletic as he enters middle age. He worked as an investigator in the Marines and a local police department and still has that military bearing. He says no matter how precisely we study the crime scene, we cannot overcome a serious problem, one the police created 30 years ago.
A crime scene is supposed to be documented, primarily through photographs, video, and there's a certain way that's supposed to be done. Well, that wasn't done at all in this case.
The BMW was towed to a police lot where it sat overnight in the rain. Police lifted fingerprints from the car the next morning, but they didn't match anyone, not even Jeffrey Young, who owned the car. No one took photographs of where the car was parked in the alley. In fact, no one took photos of the crime scene for 6 months, just before the trial. And then, during the daytime, when the lighting was different, there were new structures, and the foliage had changed. Police even failed to draw sketches of the BMW's location until 6 months later, from memory. These mistakes would come to haunt the defense. Spencer's attorney could not challenge the account of the star witness, Gladys Oliver. For example, a parked trailer blocked most of Oliver's view of the alley, but the defense had no photos to prove it. As Detective Briseno admitted to me off tape, quote, the crime scene was screwed up from the start. Parker had also asked Briseno about the lapse.
When I asked the detective, well, why didn't we take crime scene photographs? And the investigator said, well, because he hadn't died at that time. So we thought he was going to be okay. And to that I responded, well, it was still a crime. He'd still been beaten savagely. He was still assaulted. It's still a crime scene. Yeah, but we didn't think it was going to be that big of a deal. It was just sloppy, unprofessional work.
It's easy to see why the detectives would build a narrative around the eyewitnesses. But suppose just for a moment that Spencer was not the person in the alley. Why would these three people swear they saw him? He was an unlikely candidate. He wasn't in a gang, didn't do drugs, had no violence in his background. So why Spencer? One rumor was that Gladys Oliver was trying to protect someone, a friend whose last name was Spencer. Police were looking at him as a possible suspect. Some believe she wanted to divert the focus from her friend to Benjamin Spencer, whom she had seen earlier that night. The other almost universal rumor was that Oliver wanted the reward money, and having selected Ben Spencer, she persuaded the two young men to back her up. There were three eyewitnesses that night. We tracked down Gladys Oliver, but she became agitated when I tried to interview her. She refused to talk to me. The second eyewitness, Charles Stewart, died 2 decades ago in a drug deal gone bad. The third was Jimmy Cotton. Jimmy Cotton was 18 years old on the night of the crime. Now, at 48, he seems a little nervous as I pull out my microphone and begin asking questions. Initially, he repeats his trial testimony, that he had been fixing a late dinner, looked out his kitchen window, and spotted Spencer get out of the BMW and run away. Cotton had the best view of any of the witnesses, and he was the closest, but, and this is important, he was still 93 feet away, and it was nighttime. I asked Cotton what the person looked like.
He was just tall. He kind of looked like, I don't know, I ain't going to say that was him, I ain't going to say it ain't him, because it was dark.
With that, the interview becomes a confessional as Cotton dismantles his testimony from 30 years back. He saw only one man, not two. The man was rushing away from him. He never actually saw his face. According to Cotton, it was the detectives who first named Ben Spencer.
The police were saying they had Benjamin under investigation for this murder and all this. I just said, I told them what I did. I said, it looked like him, the one that got out the car. I said, maybe it was him. And they went on it from there.
We'll revisit Cotton's account later. But for now, I ask him, on a scale of 1 to 100, what are the chances that the man he saw was Spencer?
I'd say about 30% chance.
Cotton asks if anyone collected the $25,000 reward. We say there's no evidence anyone got the money. He asks if Spencer is okay. We tell him he's in prison for life. I ask how he feels about that.
I feel bad about it. I want him to get out. I really do. That's a long time to be in prison for something you didn't do.
After this brief message, we'll tell you about what Benjamin Spencer's jury didn't hear about what happened that night in 1987.
Do you wonder what Donald Trump says to the reporters he calls up in the middle of the night?
Phone rings and it's Trump's assistant and she says, Mr. Trump is on the phone for you. Hold on. And that's the thing, it's like he just calls.
Maybe you wonder why liberals sometimes seem so intolerant of opinions other than their own.
There's an orthodoxy you're supposed to conform to, and if you don't, you become a bad, evil person.
Maybe you're the sort of person who wonders if we're ready for the next global pandemic.
The most dangerous scenario is where something breaks out somewhere else in the world, and then is coming into the U.S.
I'm Jeffrey Goldberg, I'm the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, and I want you to join me on my new podcast, The Atlantic Interview, where I ask all these questions and more of Bill Gates, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, Maggie Haberman, and many, many others. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Google Play or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the courtroom, a jury sees through a glass darkly, that portion of the evidence that tells one coherent story. Early on, the detectives began to shape the state's narrative. They believed anyone who supported the case against Ben Spencer and seemed to ignore anyone who didn't. One witness they ignored was Sandra Brackens, then 14 years old, whose house abutted the alley. According to the police reports, Brackens talked to detectives just hours after Jeffrey Young died. She gave one of the most detailed descriptions of the perpetrator, the same account she tells me today, 3 decades later. Bracken says she was sitting on the porch around 10:30 that night, talking on the phone, when she saw a man run by.
He came running right here. He cut across here, and he went down that way, and then he went up the street.
So you were about 20, maybe 20 feet away from him?
Is that 20 feet? I don't know how many.
What do you think? That's close.
Yeah.
Don't you think that's close?
Yes.
We sit down inside her house. She says she didn't recognize the man, but she recalls details about him.
He had on dark pants, like a dark jacket. It almost sounded like he had on, like, I'm going to say church shoes, only because of the sound when he was running. And he had the jam box. He had this big silver jam box.
That fact, which he told police that first day, had not yet been made public. Brackens didn't see the man's face, but as he ran under the streetlight, she saw he had a dark complexion. She knew Benjamin Spencer. He has light skin.
Didn't appear to be as tall as Ben. He didn't appear to be as thin as Ben. It wasn't Ben.
You're sure?
Positive. 1,000% positive. It was not Benjamin.
Bracken says she told all this to Detective Briseno the first day, but Briseno didn't believe her. He told Daryl Parker that she might have been, quote, one of those crack whores. When I tell her that, Brackens has to fight back tears. The comment galls her, as does the assumption by those in the other Dallas that she, or any teenage girl in West Dallas, would probably be a crack whore. Bracken says she's never taken drugs. She doesn't even take Tylenol. And when she was a 14-year-old student in junior high, she was taking high school classes. More puzzling still, Spencer's defense attorney never called Brackens as a witness. Frank Jackson remembers the girl as being hostile, but Brackens says that she offered to testify. In fact, she testified in the trial of Spencer's co-defendant, Robert Mitchell. Whatever the reason, the jury never heard her story. Brackens knew all three eyewitnesses, and she recalls confronting Charles Stewart, the one who's dead, about why he accused Spencer.
That man told me. He told me that they lied. He told me that. Because later on, and I asked, why y'all lie on them people? He was like, man, we was trying to come up. So basically, for reward money. He told me that.
What did you think when he said that to you?
I was teed off. It's like, again, that's somebody's lives that y'all... For a few dollars, really?
The jury didn't hear this next part either. A few minutes after the man ran by, she, her brother, and Robert Mitchell heard that there was a car in the alley and went over to see it. She says she knows exactly where the car was parked.
The car was actually right here. It's like right here.
Right here, where these bushes are.
Yes. But it was parked in the alley right there.
Do you think that Gladys could have seen the car?
I don't. Not from a window. Not from... Unless she was standing in the backyard, I think it would have been hard to see it.
But the police never asked her about any of this, a critical detail that would have been helpful to the defense. Now, let's stop for a minute to consider the choices the detectives made as they built their narrative. They discarded the testimony of Sandra Brackens, who says she saw the perpetrator close up, and credited Jimmy Cotton and Gladys Oliver, who were much farther away. They also didn't believe Christy Williams, the alibi witness who insisted Spencer could not have assaulted Jeffrey Young. Instead, they leaned on the word of a career criminal, Danny Edwards, the jailhouse informant who said he heard Spencer confess. Daryl Parker and I pull in front of a pink boarding house in West Dallas, the last known address of Danny Edwards. Edwards had recently been released from prison. He's been in and out of jail for half his life. Edwards shared a cell with Benjamin Spencer right after he was arrested. As you'll recall, Edwards swore in court that Spencer had admitted to the crime, and that testimony was the only thing that connected Spencer to the assault. Now Edwards tells us the backstory to that testimony. Here's his account, that Jesse Briseno and some other detectives took him to a room in the basement of the jail. That the police had heard that he had confessed to Jeffrey Young's murder, and that Spencer was the one who had given him up. No, Edwards countered. Spencer confessed to me.
I just went off the handle. I said, well, it's okay. This way it is. Something happened, like we whooped somebody on the tank. Okay, my word against yours. You said I did it, you did it. That's how it started out. But when I realized it wasn't even like that, he didn't do it, and I saw the steering stuff, I checked it, but it was too late.
Edwards says that's how the game is played. You accuse your cellmates of a crime to win a lower sentence for yourself.
That's in jail and prison. The better liar, the better fighter wins.
In this case, he was facing 25 years in prison for aggravated robbery. His sentence was reduced, and he walked out of jail in just over a year. Edwards says he pieced together what happened to Young by picking up on the questions the detectives asked him.
He's telling me what they really say. He filling in the blanks, you know.
So you were just kind of making up details?
Yeah, making up what they throw out to me, I can make it up. You can tell, you can say anything to me, I can take it and make it better than what you said.
I point out that he's told lies before, under oath. Why should we believe this story?
Frankly, I'm going to be honest, I don't care, man. I'm just, you ask me a question, I give it to you. If I was going to lie to you, I wouldn't even talk to you. It'd be senseless. They were different when I was young. They were forcing us, saying, you killed him. He's saying, you killed him, you know. That's different, but that shit's over with.
Can I ask you, do you think Ben Spencer's innocent?
Yeah, he didn't do it. In my heart, he didn't do it. You know, just he lied on me and I lied on him. That's what it is, you know.
The math is getting interesting. Of the four people whose testimony put Spencer in prison, two, Cotton and Edwards, have backtracked or recanted entirely on tape. Charles Stewart is dead. Only one, Gladys Oliver, has stuck to her story, or so I assume, since she wouldn't talk. I wondered how Jesse Braceno, the lead detective who retired years ago, would view these developments. It takes us three visits to his home to finally buttonhole him.
Here he is.
How you doing, Mr. Braceno?
Braceno, a trim man with thick white hair, gives my microphone a wary glance and shoots Parker, a fellow investigator, a look of betrayal. He says he felt no pressure to close the case quickly, and they investigated thoroughly. Was it police practice, I ask, to tell a potential witness the name of the suspect and details about the investigation?
Well, it all depends on, you know, where you are with the investigation and who the person you're talking to. You don't want to lead them into making any false statement, so no, you don't really tell them that.
A couple of people, Danny Edwards and Jimmy Cotton, thought that the police had given them the information and they just kind of signed the affidavit after the police had given them the information about Ben.
We don't work that way. Yes, there you go again. Lies. It's lies. We don't give them the information. We ask them the information.
Anyway, Braceno says, why would you want to believe them now? He's right, of course. Investigators tend to believe contemporaneous testimony before a person has a chance to rework his story. Perhaps Jimmy Cotton was not suffering pangs of guilt. Perhaps he looked at Parker with his military haircut and me with my microphone and felt corralled into giving a false recantation. Or Danny Edwards, who spins lies as easily as he breathes. Maybe he was just messing with us. But a fundamental principle of cold cases is this. Time is both the enemy of truth and its friend. True, memories fade and details disappear over the years. But time can reveal truth as well, just as a Polaroid snapshot slowly reveals the details of a picture. Over time, relationships can change and loyalties dissolve. Conscience eats away at one's sleep. A person no longer has a reason to lie. In the frantic days after Jeffrey Young's murder, the police had one mandate: to ask questions, make sense of conflicting statements, and tune out the white noise to discern the truth. If people lied, Braceno says, that's on their conscience, not his.
We ask him, you know, are you being honest? Is this true? And blah, blah, blah. Oh, yeah. So what else can you do?
You run with the most cogent story you have. And yet, if the evidence seems to indicate that Ben Spencer did not kill Jeffrey Young, the question is, who did?
That's it for part one of this story, but there's a lot more. In part two of this series, Barbara investigates another theory, one that Benjamin Spencer's jury never heard, about who might have murdered Jeffrey Young. This series was reported by Barbara Bradley Haggerty, produced by Kevin Townsend, and edited by Libby Lewis, Kevin Townsend, and myself, Matt Thompson. No Way Out is adapted from a story that first ran in the January-February 2018 issue of The Atlantic. That story was edited by John Swansburg and Denise Wills. Thanks as always for listening. Till next time.